Good evening and welcome to Lehigh Valley Discourse. You can find us on WDIY.org for more Lehigh Valley Public Radio. I'm Raina Malhotra, your host this evening, and doing our audio engineering is James Johnson. This is Lehigh Valley Discourse's new segment, Teen Scientists, where we bring to you groundbreaking innovation in science, technology, engineering, mathematics, and business entirely from a teenage perspective. We also highlight excellence in high school independent research and technological development. This is the first segment of the Teen Scientists with me as your new host. I myself am a freshman from Moravian Academy, and today on air I have a special guest, Okezwe Bell, a sophomore from Moravian Academy. Hi Okezwe, how are you doing today?
Good, how are you?
I'm good. It's great to have you on air with us today. For our listeners, if you don't mind, could you just tell us a little bit about yourself, how old you are, and how long you've participated in entrepreneurship and research?
Definitely. So my name is Okezwe Bell, as they already know, and I'm 14 years old. I go to Moravian Academy, and I work with data-intensive high-level astrophysics research along with a lot of high-level computation. So that's AI, neural networks, among other technologies.
After talking to Okezwe about his own research in software development and business, we'll also discuss some of the unexpected obstacles he's had to overcome in these fields. So let's jump right into it then. Can you tell me a little bit about your scientific research projects first?
Definitely. So I really began with my scientific research in just computation. And more recently, I've been getting into the physics world. So I began developing applications for mainly software engineering for social issues. So that includes like medical students, that includes disease diagnostics, and that also includes biological classification and object classification. So I really started with the medical and therapeutic industries, and now I've expanded into astrophysics. And within that, I'm studying currently pulsars, which are highly magnetized rotating neutron stars. And I'm using computation in order to group them and understand their substructure, as well as other phenomena that occur, such as glitches.
It's all very impressive. So what were the major studies that you've worked on in the past few years?
So one of my first major studies is in crypto security and encrypting credit cards. I'm currently using blockchain and neural networks to encrypt credit cards in different manners, and that's something that I'm licensing through my business called Fiduton. In addition, I'm working on synthetic therapeutics using neural networks along with another co-founder called Oitzis, and we'll be licensing that through an app coming soon to the App Store.
So you mentioned your first business that you're involved in, Fiduton. Could you tell me a little bit more about that?
Definitely. So Fiduton is a crypto security business in which we are using neural networks and blockchain in order to develop this technology that will be able to encrypt credit cards. You know, as credit cards continue to become more and more hacked, especially during the time of COVID-19, we're seeing an uptick in all of these fraud cases. So what my co-founder Wisdom and I are doing is we have a team of very gifted individuals along with myself doing marketing and business development strategies in order to develop this technology, in which we'll license through an app along with a Chrome extension. And through that, users will be able to automatically encrypt their credit cards as well as manage their data efficiently.
And are there any other AI-based credit card encryption algorithms or services that already exist?
Definitely. And so there are thousands, there are many. And in fact, even Visa is currently using artificial intelligence to detect fraud. But the real difference with us is that we're using this special type of ledger that will be able to encrypt the data in a manner that hasn't been seen before. And I really think that's our unique value proposition, and it'll take our business quite far.
And what was the other business you mentioned?
So I mentioned Oitzis and InspoX.
Okay, so could you tell me a little bit more about Oitzis?
Yes, so Project Oitzis, as we like to call it, is less of a business and more of a project demonstration. And so what we're doing with Oitzis is that we are developing something called synthetic therapeutics, and it's a form of deepfaking technology in which we are creating type of emojis and synthetic presenters to help those who have depression and also mental issues. And with that, we've noticed from case study that those with mental issues or depression or any other form of emotional distraught, they're most comfortable and best served when they're around those that they love. However, during a time where we're implored to stay inside and be farther away from people, Mikhail and I noticed that we could create the same sensation without actually physically having the user witness it. And that's where the idea of Oitzis came about, where we're using artificial intelligence to create a synthetic person that will be able to talk to the individual and it will emulate that of real life.
So how do you think Oitzis could help mitigate the mental health crisis in the U.S.?
Definitely. So I think Oitzis could help mitigate it because of the fact that it's timeless and it can be used anywhere. And it's also free. So a lot of therapeutics we've noticed is that they become ineffective over time because those who are undergoing therapy are tired of being asked how they feel and they just want to talk to somebody who they feel comfortable around, somebody who will tell them what they need, and somebody who they're very close to. And yes, you can achieve that over time with a therapist. However, it's extremely non-cost effective and it's also after a prolonged amount of time. However, with Oitzis, you're able to connect with your loved one on a different scale. And by using artificial intelligence, we're able to mimic the same sensations that you would have if you were interacting with somebody who you love.
Are you targeting a specific population or generation with this software? For example, have you found that kids are more likely to be comfortable with a virtual therapist versus people that are a little bit older?
Definitely. So we're mainly targeting seniors and also our generation, the Gen Z, because senior isolation is now a huge crisis in the US where seniors are feeling completely isolated and cut off from their networks and from other people and the newer generation. And with that, we're giving them the ability to create and talk to this avatar that will inform them of everything that's happening, that will be able to interact with them on a whole new level. And as for youngsters, we're noticing that the depression rates are increasing, unfortunately, and so are drug rates, and that's sometimes a byproduct of depression. And we're seeing that from numerous factors, such as bullying, such as school pressure, and such all sorts of external factors that cause this. So seniors and also the newer generation will definitely benefit from this technology.
Backing up a little bit, going back to the general idea of technology, where do you see technology evolving? And what's the long-term application of all your work?
Definitely. So I think technology is evolving in manners that have been unprecedented before. And there are so many upcoming technologies, some of which I've theorized and some of which I've hypothesized and experimented with. Take nanotechnology for an example. Nanotechnology can now be used to help treat diseases that we never thought possible before, fit into extremely small spaces, even revolutionize computers. And as we even move past nano to quantum computing, we're able to achieve even more drastic effects because of the fact that quantum computing has these different quantum physics properties that allow them to complete computation in manners that we never thought before. And as for my research, I think that it's definitely beneficial long term because of the fact that it's targeting a social issue and a demographic that will continue to experience these issues.
Could you tell me a little bit about when you started getting interested in computer programming and at what age did you really realize that technology is something you wanted to get into?
So my parents are both electrical engineers, so I was definitely exposed to technology from a young age. And my brothers and sisters, they were also very into technology. They didn't all go into technology, but they went into spaces that are heavily evolved around technology, such as medicine, finance, business, / engineering as well. And because of that, from a young age, and also just from an ethnic background perspective, I was always promoted to go into STEM by my African parents. So that was something that was always driven into me. But aside from that, I really started garnering interest when I saw those in my school, my seniors, who were doing all sorts of projects using artificial intelligence and coding. And I was about 6 to 8 at the time. And that's when I really realized that coding was definitely the future.
And what was one of the first projects or experiments you remember doing? You said you started at 6 to 8. What was the first one you could remember?
So the first project that I remember that I did was definitely with the Arduino microcontroller. And it was a rather simple project where I was just turning a light on and off using a photoresistor. And basically, when the photoresistor would read the light, then the LED would turn on. And I was just so excited to see that first project work. And since there, it's kind of spiraled into this myriad of different projects.
That's all very impressive. So what are some other things that, like, you're only a sophomore in high school. Where do you see yourself in the next couple years finishing high school? How would you like to keep going with your computer programming interests.
Definitely. So as I reach the end of my high school career in the future, I definitely see myself maybe working in a nanotechnology lab, working with more exponential technologies, even being a BCI developer as like an actual BCI developer in a company and working for even larger companies rather than just startups and micro businesses. But yeah, with that, I think I will be able to do and be exposed to so many new things, and I just can't wait to see what the future holds.
That's all amazing. So you also have mentioned to me earlier that you were a lead developer at Matchmaker working on Medical Master. Could you tell me a little bit about that?
Yes. So my first project that I had done, actually I did it last year, was Medical Master, in which I created an app that uses artificial intelligence to automatically book appointments for medical students. And it's mainly targeted for fourth year medical students who are going through the match process, which is an extremely rigorous process that allows them to match for their residency. With that comes a lot of different struggles because they still have to keep up their academic requisites along with all of these different responsibilities for getting and booking interviews. However, my application automatically does that. And it was found by a group of medical students and medical doctors in residency and also completed with their doctorate. And they were developing something similar. So they brought me onto their team, and now I'm a part of the company as a senior lead developer.
So in your opinion, what new skills did you need to develop to work on this project? Or if you didn't need to, how do you think this project compared to some of your previous work?
So I definitely think I needed to build some more team skills because I had originally been kind of an individual developer or mainly the person who was the CEO or was the co-founder, unless I was a part of an accelerator or some other group. But with this, I'm working with those who are much older than me, so I kind of had to assimilate into that environment, and I think that's allowed me to kind of grow in a different way and learn kind of the different dynamics that older people have when working in a company versus people of my age.
So obviously you go to Moravian Academy. What opportunities do you take advantage of at this school? What clubs do you do or run, after school activities that they host? Could you tell me a little bit about that?
So at Moravian Academy, it's a great school, and they offer quite a few opportunities, especially in STEM and athletics, and as well as the arts. So I guess I'll start with the arts. Within the arts, I play violin, and I've been doing district orchestra for a long time. Our orchestra teacher definitely promotes going to different competitions, enrolling in different violin expositions, and doing different recitals. So I've definitely gotten a lot of exposure from her. Within the athletics, I do golf and tennis. I'm currently on the JV golf team, and I'm on the varsity tennis team, which I made in ninth grade, fortunately. And then within the academics, I currently do quite a few different clubs. I'm in DECA, I'm in Technology Student Association, I'm currently running the Synthetic Biology Club as well as Science Bowl, and then I also do chess among other clubs. So I definitely think I've exposed myself to all sorts of things within the Moravian Academy space.
Well, that is definitely a lot. You must have a busy schedule. We're going to take a quick break right now, but we will return shortly. When we come back, we'll continue discussing software development and entrepreneurship with our guest this evening, Okezwe Bell, our featured teen scientist from Moravian Academy. This is Teen Scientist, and I'm Raina Malhotra.
Spread the word about your business or organization to a well-informed audience. Become an underwriter with WDIY. Our lineup of NPR News and locally produced programs reaches thousands of engaged listeners in the Lehigh Valley and beyond. Underwriting on WDIY is an affordable and effective way to provide information about your product and services to people who care. To learn more about underwriting opportunities, 610-694-8100, extension 6, or WDIY.org.
Celtic Fair, a celebration of Celtic music and culture, from its roots in Ireland, Scotland, Wales, Galicia, and Brittany, to its branches in Australia, Cape Breton, Canada, Chicago, New York, Philadelphia, and the Lehigh Valley. bringing you music, interviews, and a weekly culture calendar every Thursday from 7 to 9 on WDIY.
Hello, and welcome back to The Teen Scientist, and I'm Raina Malhotra, your host, presenting our incredible guest, Okezwe Bell, a sophomore from Moravian Academy. Okezwe has just finished telling us about his experience and his personal life that got him interested in computer programming and science. So now we're going to dive right back into it, and I kind of want to ask you, what personally do you think is more important, entrepreneurship or development?
That's a great question, and I think that I don't necessarily value one more than the other. I think it's actually the convergence between the two, kind of coalescing them and creating something which entrepreneurship and technology are included. I think that's kind of the most important thing, where you're able to take the technology or whatever you've developed or whatever you've created or researched about and really turn it into a business or a product or something that can be used to impact others.
How can the areas of STEM that you are working in impact other fields? So I know you mentioned talking about combining computer programming with physics. How do you think these areas of STEM could impact other fields?
So specifically with astrophysics, although astrophysics isn't necessarily going to save someone's life, it can give us insights, incredible physical insights, such as like the interior of a pulsar, as I had mentioned before, or even kind of insights into superfluidity and superfluids, or the nuclear equation of state, and all sorts of type of physical phenomena that we see. With medicine, it's kind of more self-explanatory, because obviously medicine is an area where you're literally saving lives, and through that, we can also help sequence genomics, so genomic data science. We can also help with predicting diseases, as well as other technologies such as robotic surgeries, among others.
And how have you been able to do that? How have you been able to tie the different concepts in physics to coding?
Definitely. So one of my major projects was using a neural networks, in order to determine the phenomenology of a pulsar. And basically, what phenomenology is, it's just the idea that all pulsars are different and they each have kind of a different story. And the methods that I did that was I used multiple neural network models in order to create this type of reading where I could use radio spectroscopy in order to determine interiors of a pulsar, substructure, possible substructure. Of course, this is hypothesization, but it was very data intensive.
And you clearly have a wide palette of technological skills. How have you been employing these skills in a volunteer manner to help your community and people around you?
Definitely. So my first volunteering opportunity was in Zooniverse, in which I'm collaborating with a lot of other people on projects for NASA, and we're detecting supermassive black holes using LOFAR radio surveys. In addition, I've also helping crowd doing as an iOS developer, and I'm developing a sustainability app that tracks kind of your sustainability measure and promotes helping the environment. Lastly, I am also founder of InspoX, which is my nonprofit organization in which I promote students to do STEM projects as well as work in them.
And when did you start that, InspoX?
InspoX was started quite recently, actually. I recently started it in July to August, and since then I've been garnering some pretty good traction on getting students to do projects and having me manage them.
And where do you see that growing in the future?
I definitely see it becoming almost like some sort of free consultation for young students, in which when they're developing products and when they're developing projects for either competition or out of interest, they're able to apply and come in and they're getting the resources that they need, whether that be labs, technology, and soon enough, and hopefully in the near future, we'll be able to get our hands on some pretty exponential technologies where we're of like great value.
What do you think is the trajectory of the future, and how will the technologies you're researching fit into it?
So one of the aspects of the future that we're really going into is VR, where we're all spending more time inside of virtual reality. And with that comes a lot of different stipulations such as trust. And I've been working intensively with blockchain. And with a blockchain, we'll be able to manage these virtual currencies in which people are existing inside of technological spaces that aren't necessarily real, but they'll be able to conduct real life transactions. They'll be able to go through so many different things that we couldn't necessarily do inside of reality.
And which is all very fascinating. So I want to transition a little bit into some of your personal awards. One of your major accomplishments was being awarded a scholarship at RIT. Could you tell me a little bit about that, how you won that, and being named a national qualifier and some other things?
Definitely. So with respect to the RIT scholarship, I was a competitor in a competition called Inspo Science Canada. It's actually relatively new and student run, but it garnered a lot of traction due to the fact that we had to go virtual this year for a lot of, or last year actually, for a lot of our science competitions. And it was really interesting because I didn't actually realize I had won the award because I was just a finalist. And when you scroll down and you see your name, it shows you kind of all of your awards. And I thought the RIT scholarship was actually a pending award until I emailed the competition and they told me that I had won it, which was really exciting.
And for that, did you need to submit some sort of project or research?
Yes. So the project that I actually had submitted to Inspo Science was something called AIXIV. It really doesn't actually stand for something. It's more of like artificial intelligence, XIV being 14. And so artificial intelligence 14. And I submitted that. It's basically a programmatic framework that allows me to develop all sorts of neural network based applications. And one of which was Medical Master.
And when did you work on that?
So I worked on that in my ninth grade year, and I mainly started a little after the summer.
Where do you think Medical Master, where'd you take it before going to Matchmaker?
So I mainly took it to competition, one of which was LVSF, and it went pretty far until LVSF is Lehigh Valley Science Fair. And it went pretty far up to Delaware Valley Science Fair, or DVSF. And in that, I got to present my projects, send in a board, send in my abstract, and I was actually a qualifier.
And how long did that entire process take? You said you went to several competitions and have taken it to different places, but how long did the entire process take?
So the process of competition, specifically with the Valley Science Fairs, it was relatively much faster because of the fact that we were virtual. Typically, last year and the years before, it took a much longer time because they had a lot more time to deliberate. But because we were sending in a lot less information due to the pandemic, it was much faster. So maybe just a couple weeks.
And so I know that LVSF, DVSF, these science fairs are opportunities that are available to everyone, at least in our area. There's a lot of science fairs that can be done nationwide. What is your advice to high school or even middle school students who want to participate in these? How could they get started and have a successful experience in that?
So one of the ways I think they can get started is definitely by joining InspoX. I think it'll definitely give them some great exposure. But for more widely known and more widely available sources, I definitely recommend science journals, also reading kind of expositions by college students, college professors, and also just finding essays on academia along with textbooks. I think that'll give you a lot of exposure and understanding to the topic. And then you just, from there, you identify a problem, you learn how to solve it, and then you create your project.
And so do you think, you've obviously been in science for a while, do you think your projects over the course of maybe 5 years have changed a lot over time?
I definitely do think so. In fact, kind of the idea that came from AIXIV was originally from developing Medical Master. So that's kind of a demonstration on how my projects mainly kind of evolve over time as I get more and more advanced. And even my love for everything physics, kind of everything theoretical physics and like atomic, neutral physics, and also particle physics, and also nuclear physics, as well as astrophysics, of course. I think that that all came from mainly learning more about it, getting to read about it, and then seeing that neural networks, which is what I mainly deal with, could be so interoperable with this technology.
Is there something you now know and have learned that you wish that you knew before you started doing research in entrepreneurship?
I definitely think that having a strong time management, I think, is definitely like one of the biggest metrics in trying to juggle basically everything. And so when you're in clubs, or when you're doing STEM, or when you're doing a mixture of kind of everything that you enjoy, I think it's important to be able to budget your time, become effective in what you're doing, and also partner with somebody who you trust and you know trusts you and you know you work together.
So touching back on that topic of procrastination, that's obviously something that a lot of high schoolers and teenagers deal with. What are some strategies that you've found worked for you to help time manage and stay on task and balance school with extracurriculars, with different science competitions? What's your take on that?
I think getting into a good mindset and also just having a natural routine. You don't really need like a morning application or some sort of special devices to do it. Personally, I like using home automation devices, but other than that, like if you have a Google Home or you have an Amazon Alexa, just getting into a routine of a good bedtime, a good wake up time. It sounds funny and it sounds like very young, but I think it's also extremely helpful. And of course, sometimes you're going to deviate away from that and sometimes you'll have other things to do. But I think just starting with like times to sleep and times to wake up are definitely very beneficial. And from there, you'll see your productivity level go up.
Going more into the future, what are your long-term aspirations, not specifically just for your research, but just for yourself? Where do you see your businesses, just everything? What are your long-term aspirations?
I really hope to develop my businesses to the point where they hopefully become maybe Fortune 500 businesses, top trending on the stock market. I don't know, but I really hope they grow into something that can actually benefit a multitude of people and can really help people. As for my research and just for like my personal goals within my education, I hope to be a very good tennis player, be playing in college, hopefully. And aside from that, I also really hope that I'll be able to get some advanced degrees and go to even more more knowledge-based schools like medical school, or even getting a doctorate, I think would be definitely very beneficial. So I think just garnering that credibility and that knowledge from different facets of education alongside actually developing my businesses into something that becomes big and can benefit a lot of people.
So obviously you're on a career path involving technology. How do you plan on handling the negative aspects of this field in the future?
So that's definitely a great question, because the ethics of technology, especially intelligent tech, has been in question for quite some time. Personally, I think that there are obviously a lot of negative stipulations and uses of technology, but I think as technology evolves, so will our technological regulations of the technology that we're developing. And I think with that, we'll be able to moderate different uses of technology and even become more efficient in developing technologies that are restricted somehow, even better than we are now. So I think personally with that, I will personally be developing technological stipulations for different pieces of technology that I'm developing, such as with blockchain or cryptocurrency and things of in that field and of that manner. So with that, I think there are definitely methods and ways to handle the different ethics and means around which you can use technology.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Okezwe, for making the time to be with us today. It's been really fascinating to hear about your work.
Thank you so much.
And super inspiring to other students that are our age. Thank you so much to our listeners for tuning in with us today on WDIYs. It was a pleasure to talk to you, Okezwe.
Thank you.
And we can't wait to see where science and entrepreneurship takes you in the future. I'm Rana Malhotra, and this is WDIY 88.1 FM Radio. Tune in next Thursday for more Lehigh Valley Discourse, and we'll see you next time on Teen Scientist.
Goliath. Galactic Travels brings you hour-long soundscapes of electronic, ambient, and space music. The special focus for December is Matt Borgi. That's Thursday night at 11, right here on WDIY Allentown, 88.1 FM and WDIY.org.
Good evening and welcome to WDIY. I'm Prithish Kathari, your host this evening, and tonight we will be talking about climate change and energy transition with our guest, Mr. John Cerucci. Mr. Cerucci is a research professor and chief engineer at Arizona State University's Center for Negative Carbon Emissions, and prior to that worked for Air Products and received his BS and MS in chemical engineering from Penn State and Lehigh University. Mr. Cerucci currently serves on the AICHE Foundation Board of Trustees and co-chairs the AICHE Global Societal Initiatives Committee. He is also a founder of the Lehigh Valley Professional Chapter of Engineers Without Borders. I first met Mr. Cerucci when he visited my high school to talk about climate change to our science classes and thought that this was such an important topic to bring to WDIY since this segment focuses on promoting awareness of community and global challenges. So without further ado, Mr. Cerucci, thank you so much for joining me.
My pleasure to be here.
So to put things in context, can you begin by describing exactly what climate change is? What are the mechanisms? How do humans contribute? And why is it such a hot topic of discussion in environmental policy these days?
Okay, well, let's dive right into that. First of all, I have to say I'm not a climate scientist. So I look critically at what others with the right expertise have to say, but I rely heavily on them to define the problem. I'm an engineer. I work on solving problems. There used to be a lot more carbon dioxide in our atmosphere. For hundreds of millions of years, plants and animals removed it biologically, and that's resulted in our vast fossil fuel reserves. Now, over the last few hundred years, we've been burning those fuels, and we're putting the CO2 back into the atmosphere. So the problem is we're putting it back in about a million times faster than it first came out. And it's pretty evident that the atmospheric CO2 carbon dioxide concentrations are increasing. They've gone up about 25% in my lifetime. And it seems rather obvious also that that corresponds nearly quantitatively with our carbon emissions from burning fuels. So carbon dioxide in the atmosphere isn't a bad thing. Water and CO2 are necessary to keep our planet warm and support life. Without them absorbing some of the solar radiation and retaining it in our atmosphere, this would be a cold, icy place to live, uninhabitable. The thing is, we're changing the chemistry of the atmosphere rather quickly by putting carbon dioxide back into it, along with some other gases like methane. So we might expect some consequences.
Absolutely. So it's clearly a very complicated issue that is growing in severity every day. But how did you become interested and involved in climate change mitigation? Can you describe a little about your career track?
Yeah, sure. So I've spent most of my career in industry. I've been working here out of the Lehigh Valley at Air Products for a long time. I've enjoyed working with a lot of terrific people there that have taught me a lot of things. And most of my professional career has been focused on developing and designing new processes. That conveniently included learning a good bit about how to separate gases. And now I've been retired from industry for 5 years, and I'm working with a very different sort of team at Arizona State University, and we're developing processes to separate carbon dioxide from the atmosphere.
So like you mentioned, you are a chemical engineer. What kind of roles do chemical engineers specifically play in combating climate change? It seems as though they cover a pretty broad range of initiatives.
Yeah. Chemical engineers are sort of like the MacGyvers of the engineering disciplines, just because of our training and the breadth of things that we work on. A chemical engineer is sort of a cross between a physicist, an architect, and an accountant. And we apply physical sciences to manage how energy and materials interact and use that to solve problems and build things. And mostly, chemical engineers look at how things work as a system. So that makes us well qualified to work in many different fields. I have colleagues that are doctors and lawyers and astronauts, among other things. It also helps us work alongside a broad range of other disciplines to solve large, hairy problems like combating climate change, which does require many, many disciplines, including the social disciplines. So I think that all goes together. But chemies, you know, have a large tool chest of experience and training that allows them to work on complicated problems like this alongside other disciplines.
Yeah, and that was one of the things that really stood out to me during your presentation at my school was just the diversity of roles that chemical engineers can take on. And I guess that means that they can work in various settings. And you, in particular, have worked both in industry and academic settings. So I wanted to ask, what are the benefits of one over the other? What are some challenges working in these environments? And what have both experiences taught you with regard to tackling this climate change issue?
You know, throughout my career, I've really enjoyed dealing with this contradiction between the need for a commercial incentive to build things which are profitable in the short term versus the requirement to invest the time and resources to innovate around making future things a lot better. In new product development, there's this thing called the Valley of Death, and it's that time period where we might need to spend a lot of money without any financial return developing some big idea with a lot of uncertainty and hope that it's going to some future time be valuable to us. So academia has the patience to explore and develop the foundational science behind big ideas. And industry does a real good job of channeling market forces to produce things that are technical and economically sustainable. That makes for a good collaboration. And not just one or the other, but working together, industry and academia kind of bring the best of both worlds together to tackle difficult, challenging problems, certainly including climate change mitigation. Right now at Arizona State, we are working very closely with industry partners, including a new startup company called Silicon Kingdom. And so we have that marriage and collaboration of those skills. We have partners that are driven for commercial success and are focused on making things economically sustainable, and we're working on the hard scientific and engineering problems.
Yeah, that's wonderful. The coexistence is very important in combating these very large-scale problems. But to now get into the science behind it, so can you explain what are some of the technological solutions to address these greenhouse gas emissions and climate change? I know specifically you work on negative emissions technology, so could you perhaps go into those and explain why are they important in resolving this issue?
Yeah, well, first off, I mean, it's got to be said, there's no silver bullet solution. There's going to be a cadre of different solutions, and the market and economics will help deselect them. But ultimately, we're going to have to do a number of different things concurrently. So I kind of quickly move away from saying this is the one thing that's going to make everything okay. Unfortunately, that's not the reality. Perhaps the easiest and maybe laziest thing to do is nothing. We can, you know, proceed as we've gone down this path and adapt to a new way of living. The convenient thing about that is that we don't have to guess on some future uncertain outcome or model prediction. We will live it and find out what happens and then deal with the consequences. Unfortunately, there's the potential for increasing catastrophic weather events, coastlines getting redrawn. We might expect major changes in agriculture, and the most dire consequences are going to be in the developing world where people are already living on the margin. So, you know, it's kind of a bit like changing the oil in your car. I don't really have to do that. I spend money to do that. I could just let it go and probably drive my car for a few years, and maybe nothing would happen before I sell it to somebody else. But on the other hand, my engine might seize up, and the expectation is ultimately that costs a lot more money. That's the view that most people share looking at this. There's contrarian views, but the idea of doing nothing and adapting when we need to is probably the most expensive thing, both financially and perhaps in terms of people's lives. And there's wildly different predictions on the impacts. That's probably the toughest thing to guess. It ranges from, you know, the end of the species on this planet to, so we just have to turn up the air conditioning a little bit. You know, the answer lies somewhere in between, but no doubt there will be global consequential effects, and doing nothing is one way. It seems to be the way that we're patterning ourselves right now, but probably the most expensive thing to do. The other thing we can do is put less carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. And so the no-brainer thing, first of all, and this is happening to a large extent and will continue, is we reduce our energy intensity by conserving, by making things operate more efficiently. That's easy. That saves money directly and helps reduce emissions. Alternatively, of course, there's a lot of efforts looking at non-fossil fuel energy sources, renewables. There's already been really kind of substantial effects of other things like hydropower and to some extent nuclear, depending on where you are. But in terms of what's changing right now, renewables seem to be really making advances in part because they're becoming extremely economical on an incremental basis, depending on how well the sun is shining, what the price of natural gas is. Solar photovoltaic is cost competitive and getting less expensive. But these things create additional technical challenges themselves. The sun doesn't always shine, the wind doesn't always blow. And so along with most renewables, we also need to be looking at other technological advances like energy storage at the grid level. So as I said, there's not one solution, it's a combination of things. Another way to reduce the amount of carbon dioxide and other gases we're putting in the atmosphere is to catch the CO2 on its way back into the atmosphere, separating on the back end or integrated with fossil fuel combustion processes like power plants and steel mills and cement mills. And then once we do that, we need to store it somewhere. So that's probably the thing we might hear the most about, carbon capture and storage as a post-combustion process. And then the third category after, you know, adaptation or reduction is negative emission. And that's reversing things and taking carbon dioxide back out of the atmosphere. There's a number of different ways to consider doing that. Trees do it, and I'm a big fan of trees. We rely on trees and other biological sources to somehow permanently sequester that. And a portion may be sequestered in the soil naturally, or we can promote that in different ways. Another way of advancing biological sources is to use crops and trees as an energy source and attach carbon capture to that. So that lets the plants pull the CO2 out of the air, and then we catch it on the way back, and that's a negative emission process. These biological processes, I think, are really worthy of development. The issue is scale. We can make a dent in the problem by doing these things, but there's just not enough land area on the planet to plant enough trees to make a change by itself. Other more scalable concepts around are things like, some of this is a little bit scary from the geological engineering standpoint, but ocean fertilization, putting this 2/3 of our planet covered with water and promoting biological growth, algae growth, to capture CO2 from the air into the ocean at a faster rate than it's happening now. And then finally, in the area of negative emissions that we are focusing on is direct air capture, and that is by a manufactured process, an artificial tree, directly removing carbon dioxide from the air and then storing it. And as I said, I think ultimately we have to have a combination of solutions, and we'll find that combination that ultimately becomes economically sustainable.
Yeah, so definitely many viable options that you've just described. Specifically at Arizona State University, what have you been pursuing with your research over the last few years, or what are you working on currently?
So our team is working on developing direct air capture technology, DAC, or we call it DAC. And there's about 400 parts per million of carbon dioxide in the air. That's a very, very small amount. That means for every million molecules, only 400 of them are carbon dioxide. We need to separate that carbon dioxide, concentrate it so that it's nearly 100% pure, and then usually compress it up to pressures more than 100 times atmospheric pressure so that it can be stored somewhere. So I'll just say this, that's really easy to do. Simple engineering problem. We've done it. We can do it again. The catch is that it's also really expensive. It requires a lot of expensive equipment, and it requires a lot of energy. I mentioned that chemical engineers are part accountants. If we use too much energy, and that energy comes from fossil fuel derived sources, electricity or whatnot, then we can actually lose out on that gain. So the problem isn't separating the carbon dioxide from there so much. It's doing it inexpensively without consuming too much additional energy. At Arizona State University, we're developing those equipment and technologies that work like artificial trees. And as I said, I'm a big fan of trees, but our trees work about 1,000 times faster than real trees. And so we're trying to, in addition to making those biological processes look a lot better, we're also trying to change some of the paradigms in traditional industrial processes to overcome these energy and equipment cost issues by doing some really unique things, more like nature. For example, we let the wind deliver our feed gas instead of using blowers and compressors, which would consume electricity. We're looking at novel materials that bond and release the carbon dioxide without relying on external energy sources to any great extent, using things like moisture swing cycles, where our fuel is water that then is evaporated into the atmosphere. And we're also looking at ways that we can integrate renewable energy, including the integration of energy storage into these systems. So these, maybe most importantly, are process-intensive systems that are modular. And the idea is that by mass production, they can become more and more inexpensive, and we overcome not just the energy issue, but also the capital cost issue of equipment.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll be talking about the prioritization of research versus commercialization, as well as get into how has the COVID-19 pandemic impacted climate change and carbon emissions. I'm talking with Mr. John Cerucci about climate change and energy transition. I'm Prithish Kathari.
Are you interested in inspiring and informing future generations through WDIY's programming? A gift through your will, retirement plan, or estate plan is a wonderful legacy to leave to those that will need a trusted place to hear what's going on in the world. For information about naming WDIY as a beneficiary, please call 610-694-8100 or visit wdiy.org/legacy.
For program support on WDIY, we thank The Pocono Cheesecake Factory, now offering curbside pickup of a variety of cheesecake, cookies, pastries, and gourmet treats. For 35 years, helping schools, clubs, and other nonprofit organizations throughout the Lehigh Valley and Northeast Pennsylvania achieve their fundraising goals. The Pocono Cheesecake Factory, since 1985, love at first bite. For more information, PoconoCheesecake.com.
Welcome back. I'm Prithish Kathari, your host this evening, talking to Mr. John Cerucci about climate change and mitigation, as well as energy transition. So getting back to what we were talking about, in addition to these direct air capture processes, you've talked about, and I myself have read a lot about promising technologies being developed in labs or by startups that aim to harness alternative energy and prevent greenhouse gas emissions. But how quickly can this tech development through research be scaled to commercial use? And I guess this begs the following question of prioritization. In your opinion, should we be regulating the effects of existing energy industry or finance these alternative energy source developments?
Well, you know, I need to pay someone to take my trash away. And many of us pay our municipalities for our water use and sewage processing. These are costs to support our quality of life. The price we pay for all goods and services includes the costs that go into creating them. Fossil fuels are enormously useful. They are really an effective means to concentrate and store energy and move it around where we need it. We've enjoyed and benefited from their use all of our lives, and we're going to continue to do so for some time in the future. So part of that cost, part of the cost of that benefit is cleaning up afterwards. That includes the CO2 emissions, past, present, and future. Now, I'll be the first to say I'm not a policy geek, but there has to be some sort of carbon economy for anything to happen. The economic mechanism to mitigate greenhouse gas emissions has to create financial incentives, and that way market forces can take over, and that promotes technological advances, and it also drives costs downwards. The unit cost penalty to use or avoid fossil fuels can actually be quite modest. However, the issue is the scale of change is enormous, and we just really don't have that much time. So I guess I'm maybe dodging your question a little bit by saying I'm kind of lazy and I'm just doing the easy part, and that is building the technical solutions. But they only really work if we also have the policy and the social will to make change. That's where things have to start.
Absolutely. I think you've hit the crux of it, that it's not only about the technology, it's also about how we can develop this larger scale through policy. So as I was browsing what initiatives were being taken to limit carbon emissions, I found that many Fortune 500 companies have released carbon decarbonization goals. And I wanted to ask your opinion, how realistic do you think these goals are? And how do you believe these goals and projections in general about carbon emissions have been affected by the COVID-19 pandemic?
Well, I mean, we're seeing a response to these companies, which are for-profit businesses, that are, you know, taking a message from their stakeholders, their customers, their shareholders, that they have to make some changes. And so companies work that way. And so I think it's a positive sign. And I spoke earlier about that valley of death that we have to get across in terms of technological advancement. If there is incentive, even if it's modest, and it really is relative to the scale of things that have to happen, what it can do is drive things forward to advance our systems. That includes the engineering and science that has to happen, but also the thinking that has to go into policy around this. So that's the positive thing about it. It is, despite, you know, all the hype, the actual things that are happening are relatively modest compared to what needs to happen. But I'm encouraged by the positive start. COVID-19 maybe is an interesting social experiment in how the world responds to a crisis. In the short term, you know, interestingly, it seems to have provided a little bit of reduction in greenhouse gas emissions. But, you know, economic recession is definitely the wrong way to go about doing that. Maybe it is also slowing down some of the essential projects and programs that have to take place. I think in the long term, though, it's largely an independent problem. Some people would argue there's some causality. I have no ability to wade into that issue, but I think they're largely independent problems. I do think, though, that our response and I guess the variety of response to COVID-19 gives some insights on how people react to worldwide problems. It's so far maybe not really encouraging on how fast we can get our a uniform response together in dealing with the climate change. But I think there are some lessons to be learned here.
Absolutely. And just getting more on the topic of community and industry-based action, as recently as today, presidential candidate Joe Biden has talked about some decarbonization or energy transition policy that he would like to see if elected. And so this begs the question, what is the right balance, in your opinion, between industry-based action and community-based action? What advancements would you like to see being made in both sectors?
Well, I don't see them as independent and separate things. I actually think that I mentioned industry serves its stakeholders, and that's its customers and shareholders. And so as consumers, we drive those changes. And so I think that's where a change has to happen. Our politicians listen to us and try to get behind where they think they're going to be successful in representing their constituency. And industry is going to do the same. So it has to really start with the will of the people, and that's how change happens. Unfortunately, sometimes it doesn't happen until there's some pain level. I've learned that about change management. We're seeing some pain right now. I hopefully it doesn't have to get too painful, before we really start affecting those changes. But again, I think that community-based action and industry-based action are coupled together, and industry follows the lead on what its customers want.
Right. And I just want to pick up on that. You said, you know, the will of the people can help combat or mitigate some of the trends we've been seeing. So what role does promoting awareness to the public about climate change have in bringing about habit or uses change? For example, after your presentation at my school, I asked many peers if they knew about the report that you cited where, you know, they claimed that in only 12 years, the Earth's temperature will rise by 1.5 degrees Celsius, and they called it, quote unquote, a point of no return. And it's incredible to know that the severity of such a problem is going kind of under acknowledged. So what role does promoting that awareness have in bringing about a social change?
We are besieged with information these days. We have more access to more information than ever before in the history of mankind. And so there's some positive aspects to that, but it makes it very, very hard to weed through that and make sense of reality and what we really need to know to form our own positions on things. My message to you when we first met at your school and now is the same. It's not to just believe some guy like me talking on the radio, but to be inquisitive and be skeptical. If the issue is important, and this is, we have to form our own positions based on investigation and critical thinking, and particularly be wary of collective wisdom from social media. The worst and most disingenuous kind of misinformation is cherry-picked truths. And so that's why, again, if it's important, you have to dig in on your own. I'm not exactly sure how to encourage people to do that, but that's my message. And I really would hope people do their own research with an open mind and challenge your sources. You have to peel back layers. I most enjoy reading things that are contrary to my view because that's where I can learn something or perhaps discover something new. And that would be a message to anyone else.
Yes, that's a very excellent point, just about in general informing yourself about an issue, and specifically the cherry-picked truths is what we see a lot in social media these days. So I think that's a very good point. But now to move away a little bit from the science and the climate change technology part, I understand that you're also involved in humanitarian endeavors in Sierra Leone and the Dominican Republic. Can you tell us what inspired this project and what its goals are?
About 10 years ago, a group of us here in the Lehigh Valley formed a chapter of Engineers Without Borders. And our team is actually made up of engineers, but also tradespeople and medical practitioners and teachers and people with social skills. Not that engineers don't have social skills, but we need some help. And we've been working with, first of all, a community in Sierra Leone in West Africa. We worked on numerous projects rebuilding the infrastructure for a large rural school there. That included integrating a water system and sanitation capabilities and energy systems using renewable energy. Now, in that same community, we're working with a hospital. We had two large teams that traveled there earlier this year working on construction work on buildings that would house visiting doctors and nurses at a hospital in that community. We've also, concurrent with that, been working with a community in the Dominican Republic, building water systems for an agricultural community. So it's been satisfying to be able to bring some of our skills together and also work with a great team of people on these types of things. Very, very personally fulfilling for me. I would encourage anyone who is interested in getting involved or supporting our work to find out more about Engineers Without Borders. Our website here in the Lehigh Valley is ewb-lvp.com. So check it out if you're interested in learning more.
Well, thank you so much, Mr. Cerucci. This has been incredibly insightful and very inspiring with your work that you've just described.
Thanks for making it so simple. I would have liked to visit your studio sometime. Maybe I'll get to do that yet, but this was convenient. Well, it's nice talking with you.
Thank you so much. So as Mr. Cerucci mentioned, you can find his websites about Engineers Without Borders, as well as some of the research he's conducting online. Thank you for listening to WDIY. This is Prathish Kathari with my guest, Mr. John Cerucci.